Good to see Will again. Will is perhaps the finest C student I believe I've ever had. You know that's not true. You know Will is a great person. We had the class that we had together was not the easiest class, the easiest arrangement, was it? You were in Dallas taking the course, and I was in Abilene teaching the class. We had about 25 students in Abilene and about 15 or so students over at the South MacArthur Church in Irving, and we had two-way video going on, and so I first knew Will as just kind of a little tiny face on a TV screen in our room. That was not the easiest way to teach or to learn, but we developed a wonderful relationship, and I was able to come to the Dallas area and teach once at least, transmitting back to Abilene, and have come to love and respect Will so much in the ministry he does here. And it's always good to be with him, and I appreciate those kind words. This is a special place for me and for Janine. There are so many people here that we know and love. I'm grateful for so many of you, several of you, more than I can at times remember, were students in classes that I have taught or that the other Dr. Reese, Janine, have taught. So we've had a chance to visit with a number of you, and it's good to be with at least most of you. Some of you bring back scary memories of the days we were together in our classes. It's good to be with you, and to meet for some of you, to meet the parents of some of the students that we have, and those are great opportunities just to tell you how well we believe your kids are doing and what a great place this is. I love Prentice and Barbara. I've known the Metters, including their children Mark and Kimberly and all of their kids, for so many years. And I know that you have been blessed for all these years by the ministry that Prentice and Barbara have had in your midst. And I know that you miss them on this day. I love those moments of recognition. And kind of a moment that the light bulb blinks on for the first time. Something that wasn't known or wasn't seen before, and all of a sudden, this aha moment. When our number two daughter, Jocelyn, was just a baby, we were in San Antonio, and someone had just given her little clown pajamas, little tiny, thin, red-striped clown pajamas, a little clown, little cap that went on with it, just a few months old. And I held her in my arms, and we went into the bathroom and the big mirror in that bathroom, and I was kind of pointing out various things to her. You know, Jocelyn, there's the towel, huh? And there's the bathtub, huh? And there are toothbrushes, uh-huh. And then look here, sweetheart, look in the mirror. Who is that? And she's kind of looking around in the mirror. And then those eyes met. Her eyes and that little girl with a clown suit in the mirror. And all of a sudden, this dawning. Those of you who are parents, you remember this moment. She looked and you could see those wheels turning in her head. For the first time, she just kind of said to herself, "Oh, that's me." What a great moment. Some of you, most of you, have seen the kind of artwork, the posters that are out, that when you first look at the poster, they just look like a bunch of letters on the poster, just kind of oddly arranged. And the people tell you now, if you'll stare at this poster long enough, there's going to be this three-dimensional figure that'll just kind of jump out at you. You've seen these, you know what posters I'm talking about? I'm sure there's a name for these. And they'll say to you, now don't focus on the surface. Focus about 12 inches behind, which has never been easy for my mind to grasp. So you look at that, you look at that, you look and then stare at that. And my guess is that there are at least some of you in this group that have done that for hours at a time and still don't see anything there. But after a while, you look and all of a sudden, wham! These three-dimensional figures, these dolphins or Japanese samurai warriors or whatever is embedded there in that poster, just jumps out at you, just almost knocks you off your feet. How come I didn't see this before? That's kind of a sudden moment of recognition. I had one of those moments in relation to this Sunday. About a month ago, Prentice called me on the phone and he said, now, I've been in this series of sermons for months on Romans. And we are coming up at the end of the month to the last verses, the concluding verses to Romans. And he said, Jack, I want you to be the one that will present this message, this great passage at the end of Romans. I want them to hear you and to hear, this is a church that you will love, and I want them to get to know to you, and you are the one that I would like to give this concluding address in Romans. And I'm thinking, wow, yeah, well, that will be great. I said, I'll do that, and I'll look forward to seeing you there. And he said, oh, no, I won't be there. And this moment of recognition goes on. Oh, I understand. And you begin to wonder how many other preachers he had called who caught on to this a bit earlier. Yeah, Prentice was looking for a substitute preacher on this Sunday. He's going to be in Paris, France. But moment of recognition. I know what he was after. Most of you have seen those kinds of moments. If you're a school teacher, you know those moments where you're working with a class and you're working and working, and then all of a sudden, wham, they understand. They see something they've not seen before. Or a coach for a basketball team. You've worked with them all season, and they just never have quite understood how it all happens. And then, click, one game. Man, the passes are sharp, and the defense works, and everything falls together. Or at a higher level, international politics, where you've got people that can't seem to get along. You've got Jimmy Carter working with Anwar Sadat, Menachem Begin at Camp David in the 1970s, and they're working and working, and they can't seem to pull it together. And all of a sudden, on one day, on one afternoon, everything fits and a peace settlement is made. Those moments of recognition. Doesn't always happen. It's not always easy. As any of you who are school teachers are aware, it's not always easy. You work, and sometimes they just don't get it. They don't stay with you. I'm reminded of a time in my freshman Bible class several years ago. Carissa, I'm afraid that this may have been the time that you were there, though I think you were not involved in this story. I've had a bad habit. I'm not sure why I started doing this, but I greatly dislike students who fall asleep in my class. I mean, that just really grates me. I mean, I want them to at least pretend that they're awake. And so if a student falls asleep in my class and I can't get them awake, I've typically grabbed either an eraser or my black marker pen and toss it toward them in my class. I went through about 7 years of never missing a student. I mean, I was pretty confident about this skill that I had. But on this one morning in this class, I had a guy that wasn't just asleep. I mean, he was sprawled out. His arms were down and he was, you know, drooling on the desk. He was gone. He was out. And I walked up the aisle a bit, kind of talked loudly, and everyone's kind of looking around over him, and he never did wake up. And so I took the marker pen that I had and I wound up and I tossed that pen. And I mean, that pen was headed right toward him. But surely somehow, it's like the air conditioning vents caught this pen and it veered right at the last. This real sweet girl, sitting in the row right in front. I mean, she'd been paying attention every moment. I mean, just sweet face, little blonde-headed girl. That pen just went, bam, right off of her forehead. I mean, just big old welt there on the on her forehead. You know, I repented. The guy never did wake up. I mean, he just the whole way. Sometimes there is no moment of recognition. Sometimes they never do wake up. Sometimes the team never does get it. Some things you can't coach. You can't coach height. You can't coach speed. Some teams never do work together. Some governments never can get along. Witness what continues to go on in Northern Ireland or in Israel and Palestine today. It's not always easy for there to be understanding. It is that very difficulty that has plagued the church in Rome from the very beginning. As you have worked over these last several months in this congregation looking at Romans, surely it has been obvious that there have been some difficulties in that church. And a lot of those difficulties had to do with how the Jewish Christians and the Gentile Christians treated one another. Those were very different cultures. I mean, just separate and apart from what would happen inside the church, in the larger Roman world, the Greeks and the Jews and the Asians and the Jews and the Romans and the Jews just had some very difficult times getting along. The Jews' religion had been protected from the time of Julius Caesar, back 100 years before the time that Paul wrote them. When Julius was the leading citizen of Rome, he protected the Jews and their worship because they had fought with him in many of his major battles, and he had lived among them when he was a young man. And so he protected them, and they were able to worship their God as they chose. But the people in the empire never really accepted Jews and their religion very well. They thought them a bit odd. They thought them a bit strange, this worship of this God. That they would worship only one God, that they would segregate themselves from the rest. They kind of lived in ghettos, in isolated areas within the city, and wore strange clothes, and ate strange foods, and did strange things. And the Jews, as they would look at the Gentiles and the areas around them, found them equally strange. They found them a bit repugnant. I mean, the kind of foods that they ate were not the kind of foods that the Jews would eat. I mean, many of those foods they would never eat. Those were unclean foods. And there was always some tension between those cultures. Each thought the other one a bit strange. Any of you who've ever had cross-cultural experiences will understand at some level what that is like. A number of years ago, Janine and I were in Korea. It's a wonderful country that we've gone on a couple of occasions and love that country and those people. We were with one of our graduate students, Jay Che, who is Korean and grown up and lived much of his life in Korea. And he was kind of our escort and translator. And everywhere he went, he would say, this is my favorite. This is my favorite food. And we went to a tourist place near a Great Lake, and he saw a seller that was scooping something in what looked to us like a snow cone cup. Just scooping stuff and putting it in a snow cone cup. He said, this is my favorite food. He said, do you want some? And I said, no. You help yourself, though, and you get whatever that is. And he brought it over to me, and it was roasted silkworms. Now, a silkworm is not actually a worm, but it is a bug, and the legs were still on it, and they were roasted. And he was just scooping this in his mouth and eating it and offering it to me. Are you sure? Oh yes, I'm sure. But you know that works the reverse way too. Janine and I were staying at a bed and breakfast in Oxford, England, and a young French couple was also staying there, and they sat down at the little breakfast table that morning for a traditional English breakfast. This woman brought down, I mean, it was a feast. She laid the plate down. There were just big, juicy slabs of bacon and hash brown potatoes.
and toast and butter and jelly and a big stewed tomato, and right in the middle, just kind of quivering when she set it down, was a fried egg. Didn't that sound good? Any of you had a breakfast like that? That's not a strange breakfast to you, is it? You've had a breakfast, fried eggs and bacon. I mean, this was a breakfast. She set that down in front of us and set it down in front of that French couple, and she walked out, and we watched them look at that plate. And that poor girl put her hand over her mouth and almost gagged into her plate. And they stirred that around for a little bit, and she got up and had to leave. And her husband came, you know, running out afterwards. They didn't eat a bite of it. That strange English breakfast, eggs and bacon. Well, different cultures do different things. And these Jews and these Gentiles found themselves in difficult relationship with one another, even in the church. But there's hardly a church anywhere in the Roman Empire that wasn't struggling with what to do with the Jews and the Gentiles all in the same church. The Gentiles lived in a way, whether Greek or Roman, they lived in a way that they assumed by their education and by their vocation that they were in large measure superior to the Jews. They were educated in Hellenistic philosophy, and they knew things and understood the universe in ways that the Jews haven't. It felt culturally superior to the Jews, and the way they dressed and looked and ate and talked. And the Jews felt religiously superior to the Gentiles. After all, they had known God, the one God of the universe, all of their lives. They had heard the story of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob from the very beginning. Their holy scriptures they had lived with, and they knew all the Psalms and all the stories of history. They knew all these things. And so these Gentiles coming in, these new Christians, I mean, they didn't know all that stuff, and they were really very immature in their understanding. And so you had this, who's on top and who's on bottom, and who is superior and who is inferior, and whose culture is better than the others. And unlike anything that most of us have ever experienced in our daily living, there was considerable tension in these churches. And it was certainly true at Rome, but it was compounded at Rome. It was compounded because there was a large Jewish population in Rome, over 30,000 citizens. And there was a disruption in the year 49 so that the emperor Claudius kicked all the Jews out of Rome. Kicked them all out. Now, he didn't distinguish between a Jew and a Jewish Christian. They were just all Jews, and he kicked them all out. And from what we can tell from some of the writings of the time, the issue was that they were fighting one another about Christ. They were having fights, these Jewish Christians and the Jews who were not Christians. They were so disruptive that finally Claudius said, "I want all of you out." And he kicked all of them out of town. And so the church was robbed for 5 years of its Jewish leaders. Priscilla and Aquila, they were gone. Junia and Andronicus, this Jewish leader after Jewish leader in the church, they were gone for 5 years until Claudius died in the year 54, just shortly before this book was written. A friend of mine, Ken Sikraski, there in Abilene, says that this is like what would happen to a church if all of the adults in the congregation left and the teenagers ran the church for 5 years. Now, that would kind of be interesting. I'm not sure I would mind that all that much. That would be kind of enjoyable. My sense is that if there were no adults and the kids ran the worship service, it probably wouldn't have been like what we did this morning. My guess is that there are not going to be a lot of suits and ties in the building. You know, you come in with a suit and tie, you have to sit at the back. If you sit at all, you know, I don't know, the teenagers, you know, might eliminate all the pews from the building. You either stand or you sit on the floor. Not going to sing a lot of songs that were written 100 years ago. I don't know what kind of rules would be made. You can't serve the Lord's Supper unless you're wearing an earring. I don't know what would be like in those assemblies. But for 5 years, the kids are running the church. And then the grown-ups all come back. And they say, let's do it the way we were doing it before we left. This is what these Gentile Christians felt. They had been running the church for 5 years, and then the Jewish leaders came back after Claudius' death, and they saying, let's do it the way we always did it. And the Gentiles were saying, no, wait a minute. You've been gone for 5 years. We're doing it this way now. We sing this kind of song. We have these kinds of practices. We eat this kind of meat. We do these kinds of things. We have been in leadership, and they're saying, but you don't know the Bible like we know the Bible. I mean, we have known God all of our lives, and you haven't been Christians but for a few years. And all of this tension inside the church being felt between Jew and Gentile. And it is in this situation that this extraordinary letter comes from the Apostle Paul. He had not known the church personally. He had never visited Rome, though he was on his way. But he knew many of the leaders there, refers to them in the last chapter of this book, many by name, some Jewish Christians, some Gentile Christians. But he reminds them from the very beginning who this is about. It is not about you. I am not ashamed, he says, of the gospel. I'm not ashamed of the good news, because it is God's power unto salvation. That God has broken through and entered into your human situation and has called for you to see things differently and to be different in your lives and in your understanding and in your relationships. The gospel of God has broken through and has made you safe in Him together. And that gospel and that salvation has been given to both Jew and to Gentile. And from the very beginning, it has been a gospel that is received by faith from beginning to end. From faith to faith, he says. That it is God's doing, it is God's actions, it is God's power. It's not because of your special understanding, because you've gotten it all right, or because you know more than the others, but it is by God's power, by God's wisdom, it is by what God has done that you may receive it and accept it and incorporate it and be transformed by it through faith. Because, as it is written, the righteous by faith shall live. And from those opening words in the first chapter of Romans all the way through, you have seen over these last several months God's involvement and God's actions in the world, both for Jews and for Gentiles. And then it's never been because you have it all right, because you have all the right understanding, because you've kept all the laws in all the right ways. Your salvation has come at the hands of God. God has done it. He has entered in. He has saved you because all of you, he says, Jew and Gentile alike, have sinned and fallen short of God's glory. You are all enemies of God. All of you have worked against God, and God has called you and saved you. And when you were baptized, you died to that old way of seeing things and doing things. You have been raised with Christ to a new way of understanding, so that whatever happens, he is working in you, so that there is, by his power, no condemnation. Not because you don't deserve condemnation, but because God sees you as redeemed people and given you His Holy Spirit that you may call out to God in cries that are beyond what you're able to articulate, and that no matter what happens to you in this world, nothing could ever separate you from God's love. And that Jew and Gentile all are part of God's plan and God's scheme together, and therefore I'm asking you to live like it. So beginning in chapter 12, there's all this practical material that has to do with relationships one to another. I'm asking you not to be conformed to the world, he says, but to be transformed by the renewing of your mind so that you may see things
differently than you've ever seen them before. It will cause you to treat one another differently. So then in chapter 12, you just have this litany of responsibilities that you have for one another. Outdo one another and serving one another and loving one another. Show honor to one another. Be hospitable to one another. And even the Jews and the Gentiles, he will say in chapters 13 and 14 and 15, even on issues that you disagree over, even though some of you are in a weaker position, some of you are in a stronger position, there are ways that you honor one another and look out for one another's interests. And I'm asking you, even in this situation, to welcome one another and to love one another deeply, he says in chapter 15. So that when we get to these closing verses in chapter 16, these words of praise to God, all that he has said are all brought back together again for these people who've had such a difficult time getting along with one another. These extraordinary words of praise. Now, to God. What goes to God is not found till the very end, and the word is glory. Now to God is given glory. Now to God is given praise. This is not about you. When all is said and done, you'll be able to be who you are and do what you do because of who he is, not because of who you are. Now to God be glory. The God who has strengthened you, he says. Same language as he used back in chapter 1, the power of the gospel. The God who has given you power, the God who has given you strength through my gospel, the gospel that I have proclaimed all of my life, the gospel that you have lived by and has touched and transformed your life. This power that has strengthened you through the gospel and through the proclamation of Jesus Christ, he says, according to the revelation of the great mystery that was kept secret for generations and generations, but has now been revealed to you, so that you might be able to see differently. There might be a dawning on you of what things are really like and who you really are, and that by God's power, you will be changed. It is a great mystery now made clear. In Paul's writings, always, when he uses the language of mystery, what is at the foremost of his thinking is the relationship between Jews and Gentiles. It's true in chapter 11. It's true in Ephesians. It's true in Colossians. That at the heart of this mystery is that God can take people as different as Jews and Gentiles and can pull them together and make them one. And beyond that, that God will be able to give us eyes through which we might see. Here are the three words that I would give to this church today. Not just to you. I don't know enough about what's going on in this congregation to speak specifically to you as if these are addressing your particular problems. My sense is that they are affecting all of us, all through this world. And the words that I would give are words that I most need to hear. The first word has to do with relationships. It has to do with people who don't ordinarily get along by culture or by experience that God has given the power to bring together and to make one people. Let me speak bluntly. This country in which we live, which we love and appreciate, is a country that has a long and sordid history of racism and classism, where different groups have had a hard time getting together. that people on one side of town have a hard time spending time with people on the other side of town. That people of one race don't spend much time with people of another race. That we have tended to live with people who are like us. Some live like Gentiles and some live like Jews in the language of Romans. And as this country in the 1960s went through a period of rethinking its values in terms of race, and in which the government got involved in forcing this country to go through integration and to stop the separation that was so hurtful to the minorities within this culture. And it was not our finest hour in Churches of Christ. Because all across this country, many of our churches came into this age of integration kicking and screaming. And still, on most Sundays, most of our churches are still predominantly white or predominantly black or predominantly Hispanic. We've had a hard time bringing all of these peoples together. Many of you are aware that the president of Abilene Christian University a year or so ago issued an apology. It was offered at Southwestern Christian College in Terrell, but it was essentially an apology beyond that to African Americans in this country. Because up until the mid-60s at Abilene Christian University, like all of the schools in our fellowship, and like most schools across this country, African Americans were excluded, were not allowed to come to school, they were not allowed to enroll. And Dr. Money said, on behalf of ACU, I confess that we were involved in institutional racism and I ask your forgiveness. And people have said, you weren't responsible. You were a young man when all that happened. You're not responsible. He said, I'm not responsible, but I'm accountable. And ACU is accountable. And because of that event, there have been a number of meetings where African American leaders and people at ACU preachers at predominantly white churches have met together. And what has become clear to me is just sometimes so shocking and so difficult, I don't know what to do with it. Because I've heard it said over and over and over again by the African American leaders, there are two different brotherhoods, two different fellowships, two different brotherhoods. And there are a number of extraordinarily gifted and godly leaders in the predominantly African-American churches that most of us in this room have never heard of in our lives, never heard them preach, know nothing about them at all, and vice versa. Two completely different brotherhoods. This is not what God intended. This is not what God desired. That there be a group primarily of this culture and that subculture and that subculture. That those who are of this economic level, they all worship together. And those of another socioeconomic level, they all worship together. This is not what God wants as His witness to the world. God can take Jews and Gentiles and bring them together to make one church. God can take African Americans and Hispanics and Asians and Anglo-European Americans, if you will, and can pull all of us together with all of our different cultural experiences and can make of us one church, but only if we are open to what God can do. By His power, He calls for us to be alert and aware and open and listening and serving and giving beyond our circle of friends and influences and beyond our neighborhoods and beyond our part of town. But in Abilene and in Dallas and Chicago and Seattle, in this country of all places, that there ought to be the witness of people who can talk together and live together and love together and share together and serve together side by side on behalf of the gospel. How will that ever happen? It will happen because God has broken in. Because God makes it happen. Because God transforms communities of faith. And transforms human hearts. So the first word is a word of reconciliation among peoples of diverse backgrounds and experiences. God has the power to make that kind of diverse peoples one. But second word is that God
will give us new eyes to see. That which has been a mystery has now been clearly revealed. That which was unknown is now known. That we don't have to have the eyes that the rest of the world sees with. All they see is what there is out in front of them. And they can live day to day, making their money, working themselves up the ladder, living in the nicer and nicer homes, living on the edge of power and prestige and wealth and materialism, and all that can be done out in the world. But we see from the standpoint of eternity. We're looking through the eyes of our own salvation at the world through the power of Christ's own vision. So they're able to see each other and see the world differently. That we see our work differently. That we see our families differently. That we see our relationships differently. How do we transform our situations? How do we take people that don't ordinarily get along and pull them together? The answer is because we see them differently because of the power of God. How do you take a marriage that is floundering, in which husband and wife can't seem to work it out? Well, at some level, it's going to require seeing that marriage and the other partner in the marriage differently, to see them through the eyes of God. How do we keep from getting caught up in the pursuit of material gain so that our whole life is dominated by the worry over money? And the answer is because you stand in eternity and see through the eyes of what is a mystery to the world but has now been revealed to you, that God has broken in and He has different values in mind. We have been given eyes to see. We've been given ears to hear, that we may see the world and our state within it in ways that our ordinary human existence cannot comprehend. But finally, in this great passage of praise, Paul says, according to the eternal God, that He will bring about the obedience of faith, that you may respond with faith and obedience. But it's literally the obedience of faith. Those are not words that we tend to put together like that. We think either obedience or faith. But it is the obedience of faith. That is to say that we understand who God is, and what God has done is by His power, and that in faith we receive it. That we can't accomplish it, we can't understand it enough, we can't do it well enough, we can't live perfectly enough to bring it about. That we receive it in faith, but that it be an obedience of faith, that we recognize it is by God's design and by God's power that we are called to live differently. We know who we must be. And in faith, we allow God to make us that way. There is no other possibility of transformation. There is no other way that groups of people will be brought together. There's no other way that our lives will be transformed, because we don't have the power to do it well enough or understand it deeply enough. It'll only happen because God will make it so. In our obedience to faith, then in our lives, all that happens will be to His glory. And may God be with this great church. It's through this long and wonderful study that God will continue to transform you into the people that will look like and live like Jesus by His power. Shall we pray? I pray today, Father, for transformation. I pray for hearts that are soft enough to be changed, that we'll see things differently and by Your power live like it. I pray for individuals this morning who have never touched the blood of Christ, who have thought for some time about sharing in Christ's death and resurrection and baptism, that today of all days will be the day that their lives will be touched and changed by You, that You would make them different. I pray for them courage this morning. I pray for those who have needs, of troubles, of difficulties that they know they can't handle by themselves, that this group of godly people can hear their concerns and offer their lives in prayer and support them and encourage them by your power and at your hand. But I pray for all of us, Father, today, even if we sit quietly during the singing of this song, this will be a time where our eyes will be wide open, that we will be clearly aware of who we are and what you call us to be, that only you can transform us, that only you can make us different, that we would surrender to your power and celebrate the good news of the proclamation of Jesus Christ unto your glory forever and ever. Amen. Shall we stand and sing?